I cannot live in fear of a tweet.
Alaska senators are navigating changing political seas in Washington. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, February 2nd. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, lawmakers debate whether or not the state needs a new spending cap.
Having the right base number is the primary conversation that we're having right now.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Alaska's Tobacco Quitline reminds you that 88% of Alaskans don't allow smoking in their home. A smoke-free environment helps prepare kids for a healthier life and a future free from tobacco. And it makes good economic sense. Secondhand smoke damages property, decreasing its value. Exposure to its toxins leads to disease and increased medical costs. Call 1-800-QUIT-NOW or enroll online at alaskaquitline.com. This message sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Quitline.
It's a messy process and unusually slow, but President Donald Trump made headway this week on filling his cabinet. Alaska's U.S. senators have helped him to different degrees. With a new, colorful president in the White House, they have to decide how close to stand to the standard bearer of their party. APRN's Liz Ruskin reports.
Mr. Sullivan.
Aye.
Mr. Whitehouse.
This is the sound of the Senate Environment Committee advancing a controversial nomination. It was unanimous, but only because the Democrats refused to show up.
The nomination of Attorney General Scott Pruitt to be EPA Administrator is approved and reported.
The Democrats boycotted the committee for 2 days. Alaska Senator Dan Sullivan says the Democrats were throwing a tantrum.
A senatorial temper tantrum. And as all the parents here know, temper tantrums waste a lot of energy, but they don't accomplish anything.
Both of Alaska's senators called on candidate Trump to remove himself from the ticket during the campaign. But of the two, Sullivan has hewed a bit closer to the new president. More clearly than the rest of the Alaska delegation, Sullivan defended Trump's order blocking refugee admissions. Wednesday, after Senator Lisa Murkowski broke Republican ranks to say she will oppose education nominee Betsy DeVos, Sullivan said he'd vote for DeVos. Yahoo News anchor Katie Couric asked Murkowski if she expects White House blowback.
Are you bracing yourself for a critical tweet by Donald Trump?
You know, I cannot live in fear of a tweet.
In that interview, Couric played for her Trump's speech at the National Prayer Breakfast, where he spoke about his ratings on The Apprentice.
And they hired a big, big movie star, Arnold Schwarzenegger, to take my place. And we know how that turned out. The ratings went right down the tubes. It's been a total disaster. And Mark will never, ever bet against Trump again. And I want to just pray for Arnold, if we can, for those ratings, okay?
Couric asked Murkowski what she thought, and the Republican ventured to raise an eyebrow.
It is, I think, rather extraordinary, given what the focus is at the National Prayer Breakfast, to bring up ratings in that manner.
On the other hand, both Alaska senators have voted for all of Trump's nominees to reach the Senate floor so far. Reporting from Washington, I'm Liz Ruskin.
ConocoPhillips today announced it netted $115 million in Alaska last quarter, almost double what it earned in the third quarter. But the company is still grappling with a multi-billion dollar global loss. The increase in Alaska was largely due to rising oil prices and increased production, according to a company spokeswoman. Last year, Conoco brought in $319 million in Alaska. The Houston-based company is still facing tough times globally. The company as a whole reported a $3.6 billion loss in 2016. However, multiple financial news outlets reported the company's overall results were better than expected. In an earnings call with investors today, Al Hirschberg of ConocoPhillips said the company thinks things are looking up in Alaska in particular.
Only a few years ago, this segment was in decline, and we've now turned a corner.
Alaska continues to be a very productive area for us.
Hershberg talked up the company's recently announced Willow discovery in the National Petroleum Reserve, Alaska. When developed, the company estimates the find could produce 100,000 barrels per day. At state and federal lease sales held in December, Conoco picked up close to 740,000 more acres near the discovery. A state House committee heard testimony yesterday afternoon from the big three North Slope oil producers. ConocoPhillips, ExxonMobil, and BP representatives gave several members of the House Resources Committee their perspectives on how the state's oil tax structure is working. Alaska's current tax regime on the North Slope essentially takes 35% of the profit a company earns on a barrel of oil, but tax credits reduce the amount companies actually have to pay. While each company represents different fines and different areas of the North Slope with different profit margins, they had a similar message. Here's ExxonMobil Tax Counsel Dan Suckers.
The need for Alaska to maintain a competitive fiscal regime that encourages critical ongoing and long-term investment is by far one of the most important issues you face. We know it's going to be tough for you and the entire legislature to deal with this issue.
Suckers and others told lawmakers that its current tax regime, the More Alaska Production Act, or MAPA, is working.
So, has MAPA made Alaska's investment climate more competitive? Has it resulted in a more simple, predictable production tax system? Has it been working as legislators had hoped? Has it lived up to its name? We believe at ExxonMobil the answer to each and every one of those questions is yes.
The committee heard 3 hours of testimony. Lawmakers are gearing up for a tough session as they negotiate how the state will fill its multi-billion dollar budget hole. And how the oil and gas industry should help fill that hole is a particularly complicated question. Kara Moriarty, president of the Alaska Oil and Gas Association, told the committee the tax credits are working to generate new development and investment. But she also reminded lawmakers that the state has changed its tax policies 6 times in the last decade.
How can we remain competitive when the state has constantly changing tax policies?
The industry representatives repeatedly told the state that they want a stable tax regime. The committee will also hear presentations from some of the state's smaller oil companies as House lawmakers work toward introducing a bill that could again tweak the state's tax structure. Some state legislators want to write into law a new limit on how much the state can spend each year. But policy experts say it's a difficult strategy to put into effect. And Alaska already has a limit, one that critics say hasn't worked. Alaska Public Media and KTOO's Andrew Kitchenman reports on the idea.
In 1982, Alaska voters amended the Constitution to say that the state would never spend more than $2.5 billion, adjusted for inflation and population growth. But a drop in oil revenue in the following years, combined with inflation and population growth, made sure that the state rarely got close to the limit. Lawmakers in the Republican-led Senate majority, as well as the House minority, want a new limit. They say they'd like it in state law as soon as this year, as well as a new constitutional limit in 2 to 3 years. Eagle River Republican Senator Anna McKinnon says it's important that the legislature pick the right amount to base future spending limits on.
Having the right base number is the primary conversation that we're having right now on the statutory consideration.
Amendments to the Constitution proposed in the Senate and House, as well as a House bill, would base the spending limit on the previous year's spending. If the state's economy were to grow faster than inflation and population, then government share of the state's economy would shrink over time. Senate President Pete Kelly of Fairbanks sees this as a potential benefit of the limit.
Honestly, most people believe government's too big, and if you have something like that, that would probably be a good thing. And I think as we go forward, if there are flaws in that before it reaches the Constitution, we should know about them and we will have had many discussions.
At least 30 states have some form of spending limit, and many of them have faced practical problems, like Alaska. Benjamin Zeiker of the American Enterprise Institute says state spending limits aren't effective.
The same sort of political pressures and interest group demands and all the rest that lead to fiscally responsibility, however that's defined, in the first place tend to reassert themselves.
Iris Lav works for the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities, which supports federal and state policies designed to reduce inequality. Lav notes that if state spending were to fall sharply one year due to drops in oil revenue, it would ratchet down future spending.
In Colorado, the business community banded together to get rid of the ratchet because they felt that public services were really being hurt when the recession had cut revenues.
Lav says that if the state decides to limit spending, it should set the limit based on an amount, like Alaska did in its constitution. House Majority Leader Chris Tuck opposes a change. He says the legislature can impose its own informal limit on spending by being fiscally responsible.
I don't think it's necessary because we have capped our spending, self-imposed.
A Senate version of a spending limit law hasn't been introduced yet. In Juneau, I'm Andrew Kitchenman.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, snow plow politics. How the city and state are at odds over how often Anchorage roads get plowed.
People have noticed that we haven't been able to respond as quickly as we have in the past.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
As it turns out, you don't need to wear a cape to save the community or a giant S on your chest to stand up for what's right. That's because the University of Alaska is working to build a better future for our state. Through education, the university is developing a skilled workforce with more teachers, engineers, and nurses to move Alaska forward. Join the university in leading the change Alaska needs. Visit drivechangeak.org to learn more. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska.
Residents of Whale Pass have approved the incorporation of Alaska's newest second-class city. The small community on Prince of Wales Island voted this winter on forming a new city government. Residents also elected seven people to a new Whale Pass City Council. That makes Whale Pass the 116th second-class city in Alaska. The new city government has the power to levy taxes and provide services for an area that's 26 square miles on the eastern side of the island. Whale Pass is a former logging camp in the state's unorganized borough. Officials in Anchorage are considering a change to snowplow policies after a flood of complaints in the last few weeks. Responsibility for clearing many of the city's busiest and biggest roads after a snowstorm is shared between the municipality and the state. And as Alaska Public Media's Zachariah Hughes reports, city leaders say state budget cuts have left a mess.
Assembly members in Anchorage are used to residents calling about unplowed roads, but this year is special. Forrest Dunbar represents the east side of town and says a lot of the messages and calls he gets from constituents are about major roadways like Muldoon and Tudor that are supposed to be handled by state maintenance crews. More alarming was who he heard from after last week's snowstorm.
Just recently, I had some medical professionals reach out to me and say that they're seeing a tremendous amount of injuries come into the ER from crashes. And a lot of those crashes happen, again, on the bigger, faster state-controlled roads that aren't being properly maintained.
The claim that poorly plowed roads are leading to more accidents is tricky to prove. Area hospitals don't track the cause of traumatic injuries, so there's no way to quantify how many admissions came from car crashes. Data from the Anchorage Police Department shows a high number of accidents and distressed vehicles during recent heavy snowstorms, much of it concentrated around the major roads under state jurisdiction. But those tend to be the roads that see the highest traffic, where most accidents occur in winter and in summer. And more people just crash their cars when there's bad weather. So police and officials are hesitant to point to snowplow policy as the culprit. But there most definitely is a drop in the state's ability to clear roads.
Right, yeah, this is the new normal.
Shannon McCarthy is the spokesperson for the Department of Transportation Division in charge of Anchorage and says the budget for snow plowing has dropped 16% over the last 2 years. That translates to a loss of 15 positions in the South Central region, as well as less heavy equipment.
People have noticed that we haven't been able to respond as quickly as we have in the past.
The cuts have been incremental and especially hard to notice given the last two mild winters for the region. But McCarthy says this year's back-to-back storms are straining resources.
With budget reductions, both in terms of we're trying to save overtime for the most serious events, And then also we have fewer people to call in for overtime. So we lack the capacity to fluctuate that workforce upward.
When it snows, the state prioritizes clearing the Glen and Seward highways, as well as Minnesota Boulevard. The next tier of roads are the ones within the Anchorage Bowl that impact the densest residential areas. Abbott, Huffman, Tudor, Muldoon, A, and C Street, along with sections of Northern Lights and Benson. The state's plan calls for those to be plowed within 36 hours of when a storm stops. Mike Abbott is the Anchorage city manager and says the current arrangement is the result of a 1991 agreement that's been updated and adjusted over time.
Looking at the map now, it's really hard to understand the rationale for state ownership of one road versus muni ownership of another.
The city, too, is trying to do the same workload but with less resources, having trimmed money for road maintenance in its own 2017 budget. But Anchorage officials insist recent problems are disproportionately from the state side. Abbott says the issue is prompting the city to look at taking over plowing responsibilities for some of the most crucial traffic corridors.
It's become a little lopsided. And as a result of that, the mayor has directed me to begin a conversation with the state that would find some way to try to unify winter maintenance.
Abbott and others say discussions on any unification measure are still in a very early stage, and that there are no details yet on the millions of dollars in yearly funding that would be involved. Mayor Ethan Berkowitz has been criticized by conservatives after remarks last week that some say framed plowing as a financial choice between maintenance and public safety. The administration says the mayor's remarks have been grossly mischaracterized and that city services have never been presented as one-for-one trade-offs. In Anchorage, I'm Zachariah Hughes.
Alaska's Marijuana Control Board has rejected a proposal to allow on-site consumption at licensed pot shops. KTOO's Jacob Resnick reports from Juneau.
The state's Marijuana Control Board was set to regulate the consumption of marijuana at licensed retailers. If it had been approved, Alaska would have been the first state in the nation to allow on-site consumption. But that's now moot. A 3-2 majority voted to shelve the regulations after the control board staff said public notices contained errors and a decision would have to be postponed for at least another 30 days. Control board member Mark Springer of Bethel said he worried how the feds would react to marijuana consumption in public. Pot remains illegal under federal law.
We don't want to draw a whole lot of attention to what is going on in this state with marijuana. We don't want a million people getting off of cruise ships in Juneau saying, oh yeah, you know, it was great. We were able to go over to half a dozen stores and smoke marijuana because it will draw a big spotlight on us.
The control board has received dozens of public comments, many of them negative, ahead of its third meeting where it considered the rules. Both Nicholas Miller of Anchorage and Brandon Emmett of Fairbanks, who are on the board as representatives of the industry, voted to keep the initiative alive. After the vote, business owners from Alaska's fledgling legal marijuana industry said they were dismayed by the decision.
They're putting everybody in violation that's going to be up here consuming, and it's sad.
That's Tara Bass, owner of the Remedy Shop in Skagway, the state's first licensed retail marijuana store. She said renovations had already been made in anticipation of the new rules.
We prepared it to be an outdoor consumption area, so it would be plenty ventilated, and it's just interesting that they're not giving people a place to go.
Carrie Kerrigan of the 250-member Alaska Marijuana Industry Association said retail outlets will need to regroup and rethink their strategy before bringing the issue back to the board.
What I'm going to do is push the membership to put forward solutions, to not just say, I want on-site consumption. How do you want it? And how are you going to accomplish that? And how do you make it so it's not a health concern, so it's not a public issue, so it's not something that's blown smoke in everybody's face, so to speak?
Voters in Alaska approved legalizing marijuana for recreational use for those 21 and over in 2014, but it's fallen to the 5-member Marijuana Control Board to write the regulations of how to manage lawful consumption in the state. In Juneau, I'm Jacob Resnick.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Wells Fargo, with over 13,000 ATMs and more than 6,000 branches coast to coast. For a branch location near you, visit wellsfargo.com.
And by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. Artists, show us how you inspire Alaska. Apply now for an individual artist award. Deadline is March 1st. Learn more at rasmussen.org/IAA. This message sponsored by Rasmussen Foundation.
President Trump's executive order that suspends refugee resettlement is having impacts in Alaska, where about 140 people are resettled every year. One refugee, an artist from Iraq, is working to help the community learn more about the new arrivals and what the executive order means for the community. Alaska Public Media's Ann Hillman has more.
Mohammed sits in his small anchor department, drawings and paintings hanging from walls and leaning on tables. He asks that we only use his first name. He pulls out a small portrait he just completed and the tiny photo booth snapshot it was based on.
His friend, he gave me a picture. He's like, I need this. I thought, are you sure?
The result is an elegant, detailed painting of a young woman making a ridiculous, goofy face. Mohammed, a refugee from Iraq, started drawing and sculpting as a small child, then eventually earned a degree in fine arts. In Iraq, he owned a large art gallery and taught classes. But 3.5 years ago, he moved to Alaska with his son because they were unsafe in their home country.
He came to the United States with the suitcase, that's all.
That's Hyatt, who's helping translate because Mohammed is still learning English. He says his dream of starting a new gallery is a ways off. He has to learn the local rules and regulations. But he has recently started teaching again.
He say, I was so happy when I teach because I remember when I taught in Iraq.
Mohammed is working with a group of refugees from around the world to draw portraits for an upcoming art show. Jessica Kovarik, the director of Catholic Social Services Refugee Resettlement Program, says the event was planned before Trump issued the executive order on refugees.
It's a really great opportunity to introduce refugees to the larger Anchorage community and really help them see that they are people just like you and I who are wanting the same opportunities that any of us do.
She says the executive order, which suspends the refugee program for 120 days, is having an immediate effect on Anchorage families. 78 people were due to arrive before September. Most of them already have family members who are resettled here from Sudan, Somalia, Ukraine, and South Sudan.
So the people that we were going to be resettling this coming month, we don't know when they'll be coming because all of their security screenings, their fingerprints, their medical screenings, all of that will have been expired. So they have to go back to the beginning.
She says now it could take years before they arrive. Mohammed is worried that the 90-day travel ban for Iraqi citizens will delay getting his brother's family here, too. Just a few months ago, more of their relatives were killed by the so-called Islamic State. But Mohammed says that now he's starting to worry about his son's safety here in the U.S. His son, Adam, says the bullying at school is escalating and people joke that Trump will deport him. Mohammed says he's worried.
I don't care about myself, but I care about my son.
From the Urban Affairs Desk, I'm Ann Hillman.
The art show will be at the Anchorage Artists Co-op in the Key Bank Building in downtown Anchorage from 5 to 9 p.m. on Friday night. Iraq's neighbor Iran is also on the travel ban list. John Parsi is of Iranian descent and is an Anchorage attorney. He was born in London during the Islamic Revolution in Iran. Parsi's father was a translator for the British and U.S. governments. He says they were forced to move back to Iran when he was 3 years old. He has a memory of a neighbor's home in Tehran being bombed. He says he ran outside and the house was gone. He says his family were Zoroastrian, a small religious group that was not treated well after the revolution. His family eventually was granted asylum in the U.S. and moved to Arizona in 1985. His parents still live there. Parsi says he's getting married in the fall and worries his Iranian relatives will not be able to attend the Alaska wedding.
I have one cousin who has fled Iran, again, for religious persecution reasons. She's Zoroastrian and was able to make it to Austria and is in Austria while there's a U.S. agency that assists people who are religious minorities, Baha'i, Jewish, and Zoroastrian and Christian who are escaping Iran for religious persecution purposes. They work hand in hand with the United States government to get those people generally to Austria, but into Europe and then from Europe to the United States. So her status, her ability to come to the United States, obviously in limbo, restricted for the next 90 days, but in limbo for an unknown amount of time.
In the order, the President Trump said that persecuted religious minorities would be given priority. He mentioned Christians, but do you think there may be a pathway, especially for your cousin who is in this limbo status right now, and the fact that your family comes from a small religious minority, Zoroastrian?
I'm not sure because there had, I mean, the discussion so far has primarily been about Christians from those areas, but that part of the ban or the provisions within the ban that permit people who are members of religious minority groups, the only one that I'm aware of that has been identified are Christians, hasn't really gone into effect. So we don't know what the impact will be there, which religious faith will be selected as being permitted to enter or not enter, or what that process will look like.
Do you think that there is any merit to the concerns of the side that says, look, we have to make sure that the United States stays safe, so here's what we're going to do this, even if it's a little jumbled and confusing for people, this is of national security interest. Do you think there's merit in that?
Yes, I think there's merit to say that there are security issues and we should be concerned about national security, 100%. But I think where I would disagree with that is that I don't think that a hasty decision made in this manner, being selective of countries, the kind of way that this plan was implemented, does very little in my mind to produce that security and instead creates confusion. But I certainly think that there are plenty of people who believe that this policy will provide security and that motivations of security are perfectly fine. I just don't think that this policy, the way that it was implemented, that those things are going to have that desired outcome.
John Parsi is an attorney in Anchorage. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. Tonight's stories can be found at our website, alaskapublic.org. You can also follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., Andrew Kitchenman, Jacob Resnick, and Rasha McChesney in Juneau, and Elizabeth Harbaugh, Zachariah Hughes, and Ann Hillman in Anchorage. Our audio engineer is Eric Bork. Sean Dugan is our editor and producer. Wesley Early is our web editor. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Northern Air Cargo, providing freight transportation to 13 rural Alaska communities. NAC offers a variety of service options to get the freight where it needs to be safely. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956.
And by
Condor Airlines, with nonstop service from Anchorage and Fairbanks to Germany and beyond. More information available on condor.com. Condor, born to fly. If you're a rural Alaska resident, consider applying for a seat on the Federal Subsistence Regional Advisory Council by Friday, February 3, 2017. Applicants with knowledge of regional subsistence uses, customs, and traditions are needed. Council meetings serve as a forum for subsistence management. More at 1-800-478-1456. This message sponsored by your Federal Subsistence Board and the U.S. Departments of the Interior and Agriculture.
The Alaska Public Radio Network, in cooperation with our member stations, provides the most complete, timely, and accessible source of Alaska news, current affairs, and cultural information.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.